Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 16th of November. Sorry for the hiatus last week, and thank you to those of you who sent me get well messages. It really was only a cold, but the cold made my voice something no one would want to listen to, and left my brain in a state that couldn't produce anything worth hearing anyway. This week we're back to normal. I have always had the intention of recording 2 or 3 weeks ahead of time, so that there is no risk of gaps like this. I would love to be that sort of person, but in the year and a half the podcast has been going, I think I've only achieved it a couple of times. One good thing, though, this incident was a useful reminder that all the back numbers of this podcast are available for you to listen to all the way back to March last year. If you listen through Spotify or Apple Podcasts or YouTube, they may give you the whole list. If you look at the podcasts page on the Universalis website, you will definitely see all 90 of them. Enjoy exploring them. November continues, the month of the dead. I thought I'd try looking something up. This being the internet, I knew that the answers would be various and all of them would be untrue, but all the same, out of all the Christians there have ever been, how many of them are alive today? One site said that it was 1 in 3, which is an easy number to remember. In other words, for each one of us who is walking around on the earth today, there are 2 of us on the other side of death, with God or on the way to being with God. This is a nice human proportion, and somehow it makes it easier to unite ourselves to them in prayer. The audio serialization of Dom Elred Watkin's book Resurrection Is Now carries on. New installments come out on Monday and Wednesday each week, and since we are halfway through November, that means we are halfway through the book as well. 4 installments have gone, and there are another 4 to go. It is not too late to start. You can find every installment in the same place that you find the back episodes of this podcast. When I started recording the book, I did so because I thought it was a good idea. What more of a reason do we need for doing anything? What I have discovered since I started is what an amazing book this actually is. There is nothing like reading a text aloud to make you engage with every single word and phrase and sentence of it, as you try to give each of them all the value and meaning that they possess. If you have the same opportunity to do that sort of thing with, let's say, the Liturgy of the Hours, it's well worth trying it. Best of all, it's worth trying it when you're on your own. I know we are meant to be all about community and doing things together, but when you do try to do this thing together, recite the psalm exactly in step with all your neighbours, stand up when they stand up, sit down when they sit down, kneel when they kneel, you get so focused on the synchronization of your words and your actions with everyone else's that you actually don't notice what those words say or what those actions mean. Whereas if you are on your own and sure that no one is listening, you can set out to bounce the words off the walls of your empty room, and you will focus on the words themselves. In trying to do justice to them, you will find yourself giving every one of them its full meaning. You will know what they mean, and when you say them, you will mean it as well. Sometimes, when reading Resurrection Is Now to record it, I have had the feeling that you could take almost any 2 sentences of it and make a sermon out of them. When Dom Elred says resurrection is now, he means now. He is not telling us what we are assured of in the future. He is saying that somehow all death, decay, or loss now contains resurrection already within it. As you walk across a half-frozen field in January, the rotting stalks of the plants already contain within themselves next spring's shoots. The resurrection of natural life is already here. And that is only one example. I wonder if this particular vision of resurrection comes of being a monk. Dom Elred arrived at Downside as a postulant at the age of 18, having chosen the place without ever having seen it. He will have known from the start that practically everyone he saw on that first day would die while he was in the monastery. They had the age, they had the seniority. In such a context, death is not a tragedy, something outside the ordinary course of things, something we have a right not to expect. It is as normal as breathing. On the last day of his life, I am told, Dom Elred went to matins as usual at 6:30 in the morning. Then he said, "Pray for old Bushy, won't you?" Went to his room and died. Nothing could be simpler. If we really did believe that resurrection is implied in death, how different our obituaries would be. When you look in some serious publication, perhaps history, perhaps science, perhaps mathematics, from time to time they will have announcements of the deaths of eminent people. And even though these people have lived careers full of respect and achievement, those announcements always seem to start by saying, "We are shocked, saddened, or whatever." How nonsensical this is, you can see if you imagine the writers of those pieces going to a concert, and at the end, while the entire audience, apart from them, is applauding the beauty of the music, they just sit in stunned silence because it is over. How nonsensical, how absurd, how anti-Christian. If we were true Christians, wouldn't our obituaries start, "We were delighted to hear of the death of so-and-so, of the fulfilment of his life, his coming home at last to God"? If we Christians were true Christians, wouldn't our funerals be occasions of rejoicing? At this point I was going to say, why not gold vestments instead of black, as if it were something new and grand and radical, but fortunately I did a little research first. When I looked up paragraph 346a of the General Instruction of the Roman Missal, the way one does, I found that it said, specifically for England, Wales and Scotland, that white is permissible at funerals in place of black. Since it is well known that liturgically gold is a kind of white, there is nothing at all to stop us demanding that the priest at our funeral should celebrate the Mass draped from head to foot in cloth of gold. Yes, death is sad. I do not deny that. To lose someone close to one is to wander around for the next 6 months with the back of one's head blown off. Even decades after my father's death, I still find myself suddenly missing him from time to time, a moment that is especially agonising because I have no defence against it, because I didn't know it was coming. But that is all me, not him. When we mourn the dead, it is for ourselves that we are mourning, not for them. We are mourning our loss, but as we do that, we need to remember their glory, to mourn for ourselves, but rejoice at their coming home to God. November is not only the month of the dead. It is also the month of the end of everything, the final month of the church's year, because that year begins with Advent, and Advent Sunday is the Sunday nearest the 30th of November. In these final weeks, the readings both at Mass and in the Liturgy of the Hours become more and more eschatological. This coming week is the last week before the triumphant solemnity of our Lord Jesus Christ, the King of the universe. I think in this week it might do us good to contemplate the end of the whole world, just as in many ways for the whole of this month it has been doing good for us to contemplate the end of ourselves. One day, with my doctor friend Corinne, who left us 12 years ago, something I did not approve of at the time and which left a gap which can never be filled, we got to talking about what would happen if we knew exactly when the world was going to end. To pin it down and make it concrete, for instance, let's take an asteroid, because asteroids are always fashionable, and let's say that astronomers have told us, today, absolutely for certain, that in 10 years' time, on Friday the 16th of November 2035, a huge asteroid is going to strike the Earth and wipe out all life on it. What we found ourselves asking each other was, what are the consequences? Corinne, being a consultant in public health medicine, was in the business of getting people to stay alive longer, which sadly often meant telling them to give things up. So immediately she knew what her first action would be. She told me, I would go round to everyone, telling them to smoke and drink as much as possible. Like so many remarks made on the spur of the moment without thinking, this one is theologically very sound indeed. We don't even need the wedding feast at Cana to remind us. It's far more general than that. A grape harvest, picked, trodden, fermented, bottled, laid down, is a work of art. A work of art is a participation in the beauty of God's creation. It demands to be appreciated, or we are disrespecting not only its makers, but its maker. Wine is appreciated by being consumed. So the coming end of the world does not give us permission to drink up the great vintages of the past. It imposes that duty upon us. God did not make the good things of this world in order for us to spurn them. It doesn't matter who you are or what kind of work you do, this thought experiment is actually a health-giving exercise. In many people's lives, there comes a moment when, for the first time, they feel mortal, and for many of them, that mortality is a moment of growing up, a moment of reality, even a gift. In fact, it is a liberation after the terrible on and on and on immortality that drives some of us mad in our early 20s. That same liberation happens when we think not of each of us as individuals, but of the world as a whole. Freed from the bonds of future time, we can contemplate clearly what we do is for, what we are for. And when we come back home from the thought experiment, back to a life without imminent asteroids, that clarity can give our lives some shape. To put it another way, contemplating a future without a future, we see ourselves untying the bonds of future time. Coming back from the edge of eternity, we can understand our life in time better, and we have the chance to live more freely where once we were bound. One example is the nexus of money with future time. Money is, and always has been, useless. Its sole value lies in what we can do with it at some future moment. Economists have a grand word for that: deferred consumption. When I have a sudden generous impulse and then think I can't afford it, what I am meaning is that what I do generously now leaves me vulnerable for the future, leaves me vulnerable, leaves me dependent one day on the generosity of other people, and I don't trust other people. Thus, my bondage to money is really a bondage to the future, a distrust of a future which, without money, I cannot control. It is all fear. So, what if there is no future? Then surely there will be no fear, no money, no bondage to money. There being no future to fear, we can live in perfect freedom. A world without time is a world without money. Freed from control by fear, how will people be? Today, if I want a sandwich for lunch, I go and threaten a shopkeeper. I wave a weapon in his face, not a revolver, but a banknote. I say, if you do not give me what I want, I will go away and take this piece of paper with me. You will be just that little bit poorer. Your children will be just that little bit hungrier. Your family will be just that little bit more homeless. My threat as an individual is a small one. You, the shopkeeper, can survive it. But that same threat coming from hundreds of people like me, that you cannot survive. Surely it is fear of this that keeps you going, getting up early, working all hours in all weathers. I said, surely, but is it true? In fact, there are people who love to see other people fed, other people looked after. Given just a week of the world left to go, they can think of no finer way of using the time. The goal of their work, in that case, is the work itself, not fear of the future. I talked to a waiter once who taught me a lot about waitering as a vocation. Did you think it wasn't one? For some people it really is. Whenever he saw people coming in to have dinner, he thought, what kind of experience did they want? Friendliness or respect? Talk or silence? Constant attention or utter absence until the precise instant when they wanted him? And having worked that out, or guessed it, he gave them what they wanted. He was just like a theatre director directing a play, except that his play would be tailored to each individual seat in the theatre. End of the world or no end of the world, what could make him give that up? One final example. There are people who drive buses for a living, to make money to feed their families. There is no dishonour in that, but is it the true motive? Because you imagine for a moment that you have the power to take 60 people who want to be somewhere other than they are and to take them all to where they want to be. Would you willingly give up that power even if the world was ending? It was a relaxed afternoon conversation Corinne and I were having, but the theology of work is serious theology. Dorothy L. Sayers wrote about it just as the war was ending and a new world was coming, and no one knew what that new world ought to be, and they were arguing about it. Pope John Paul II wrote an encyclical solely dedicated to the dignity of work. By imagining the asteroid, we saw work for a moment in its pure aspect, its eternal aspect, you might say, and understood something about it even for ourselves, without this confusing business of money getting in the way. When we came back again to this busy world of ours, we were able to understand it just a little better. Almost whoever you are, this sort of exercise makes you think, and it shows you a little more of what the world is, and perhaps even what you are. A lawyer wondered what would happen when time was running out, so that a burglar would face a life sentence while a murderer would only get 6 months. Someone else in the same context told me a lot I never knew about how most societies, even in the most extreme situations, do not sink into chaos, but maintain a level of order in which people can live. We can wind this story up liturgically. We could keep cool about it and say that Friday the 16th of November 2035 is the feast of St. Edmund of Abingdon in England, St. Margaret of Scotland, St. Gertrude, and, in Poland, Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine, all the successor states of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, it is the feast of the shrine of Our Lady of the Gates of Dawn. Isn't that enough for anyone, we'd say? Let's stick to it the way it is. But think how wonderful to have the opportunity to spend time giving thanks to God for all the gifts he has ever given us as we get ourselves ready to hand them back to him. We can thank him with the Mass in every form we know. The Sarum Rite from medieval England, the Ambrosian Rite from Milan, the Mozarabic Rite from Spain, heaven knows how many exotic Eastern rites, the Tridentine Rite, and our own neat workaday Novus Ordo. What a privilege to be choosing the readings and writing the prayers for such a liturgy. What a marvellous exercise it would be to plan such a thing, asteroid or no asteroid. And that is the end of this particular story. Perhaps it will spark something off for you. For myself, I have to say that having prepared to talk about it in this podcast, I very nearly changed my mind and deleted the whole thing because there was one class of people I had forgotten. In everything I have said so far, I have been talking in terms of people who are getting along in their lives, in a career or in a job or in a vocation, like my waiter friend. They manage or they don't quite manage, but there's no big drama. Their lives are ready to be wound up, wrapped up, completed. For them, the end of the world can be peace. But there are also people who have lost everything. Everything. They had everything, life, home, family, work, and it all went. Your imagination will suggest a dozen possible reasons why. They are like someone who is caught in a landslide or an earthquake, pulling at the rubble with his bare hands, trying to get out. They go to work at 6 in the morning and come home at midnight for weeks, months, years, struggling to get back something of what they have lost, to get back, above all, into a state of self-respect. Their fingers are bleeding, their fingernails have worn away long since, and still they go on day by day, putting one stone away here, another stone there, scrabbling at the fallen earth. Day by day by day, and here I am, blithely proposing an exercise to them. Let's imagine there are no more days. Is that a spiritual exercise or a spiritual torment? Not having been, myself, in quite this situation, I have no right to speak. But let me try just a little. Let's remember first that Jesus says to precisely these people, "Come to me, and I will give you rest." He does not lie. Indeed, he is there standing next to them, even in their few hours of sleep, pulling at those same stones. And then, we have to remember that the value of what we do towards a goal lies not just out there in the future when that goal is eventually achieved. The very existence of that goal shines backwards through time, from out there in the future to in the here and now, and it illuminates it all. Every day may seem grey with toil, but in God's eyes, that is to say, in reality, it shines with the brilliance of what you are using that day to strive for. It is all light. And it shines now even if you don't see it. If the world ends between now and the time when your children eat your food, in your house, wearing your clothes, then if there is no earth left for them to do it on, they will do it in glory in heaven. For you, then, the exercise of the asteroid has a message much simpler than our subtle questions of wine, or time, or money, or law and order. In fact, you may as well forget the asteroid altogether, because it has nothing new to teach you. All you need to know is what you already know. God is with you, side by side with you. God is with you, now and always. Let's calm ourselves down with a software story. There is a new feature in Universalis, in the apps on the iPhone, the iPad, and Android. Some of you have asked me for coloured backgrounds, perhaps parchment, perhaps duck egg blue or pistachio ice cream green, perhaps the brave pink of the Financial Times or the Gazzetta dello Sport. Now you can have them all. In Universalis, tap in the middle of the screen, the middle, please, not the top, to make the toolbar appear at the top. In the toolbar, tap the rightmost button. That brings up the fonts screen. It used to control just the brightness and the size of the type. Now it controls colour and tint as well. In the middle of the sample text in the screen, there is a coloured four-headed arrow control. Drag it to get the colour you want. That's all for this week. Sorry again about last week's absence. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.